Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning in to Truth and Justice. You are listening to the Friday Follow-Up for Season 13 and the Murder of Jody Jones, Part 2. We have a lot to talk about this week as Bob broke down the timeline for Luke and Jody on the night in question. On top of all that, we have Delphi news and add-on news. I'm happy to be back, and as always, I'm joined by Bob and Janet, and I cannot wait to discuss all this with you. But before we jump into that, I have one quick housekeeping we're going to get out of the way really quick. It is not a good housekeeping. It's a sad housekeeping.
It's an update.
It's an update. It's not housekeeping. I apologize. It's a sad update. My case from a few weeks back, Gus Red Eagle, he was found deceased, and they just had a funeral for him this past week.
And were you able, because so Erica Cantor, who's been doing a fantastic job of keeping us updated with his missing person cases. And by the way, we're gonna triple up next week on them because we just have so much to cover this week. I do have some that Erica has sent us, but we just don't have time today. But Erica had found, she had a Google alert set and found an obituary for Gus.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all we could find. We couldn't find anything
else
that said what happened.
Even on the sibling social media, there was not, I mean, there was mention of the funeral, but there was no mention of like ever finding a body or anything like that. So it's a sad update, but one that needs to be brought forth.
Yeah.
Yep. So that's, and it's a couple of weeks, well, in the last 3 weeks, we've had two of the missing person cases who have been found, but it was sad news. They were not found alive. So that's going on. We're going to have more missing persons cases for next week. There is also, if you look on the Truth and Justice fan page, Jarrett Brooks' case, which I believe was the last one that we covered from Arizona. They're doing a large area search for him, and I believe there is a link where they're requesting some funds to help with equipment and stuff for that search. So if you're on the official Truth and Justice podcast fans page, we'll look for that post. I'll try to have it pinned. If anybody can donate or participate in the search for Jarrett, that would be great. And with that, we got to keep right on moving today because we've got a bunch of questions about Luke and Jody's case. And a couple updates about Ednan's case and a pretty crazy big update about the Delphi case that we want to talk about. To start off with, so Ednan did actually a press conference today from his house. And Janet, in just a minute, is going to talk about that because I wasn't able to see all of it. She saw all of it. Prior to that, in the Ednan space, so I officially, over the weekend, about a week and a half later, got a response from Brett, and they have declined to do a public conversation / debate about the case. He had already said they didn't want to do a debate, and I had told him that, you know, it doesn't need to be a debate. I would just like us to have a friendly conversation and not these, and I had told him, I said, that we should show people that we can disagree about a case and have a friendly conversation about it. He finally got back to me and said that there's too much heat and vitriol going around now, so they don't think that's a good idea. He wished me luck, and that was the end of that. I did reply and said that I think the heat and vitriol are all the more reason for us to get together and have a conversation, and didn't hear back from that. So that is the crossover episode sounds like, unless something changes, is not going to happen. What I did tell you guys is that if they were not going to come on and defend their work, because at this point, that's the way I feel about it, is they waded in and decided to cover an active case that is currently being litigated. They have, I'm going to be very blunt here and it's going to upset some people, but I'm going to call it like it is. They misrepresented evidence. They flat out lied on multiple occasions in order to convince lots of people that Ednan is guilty. And they are, if you've been listening to the reply brief on Patreon, you see I'm not sharing opinions with you on the case. I'm not arguing about what people think. What I'm pointing out are things where they say the evidence says something, like they say a witness said something in particular. And that's not at all what they actually said. And I'm correcting that record over and over and over again. But this is, I can't stress enough, and Janet's going to get into this here in a second. This is an active case that is currently being litigated. They are professional prosecutors, and they chose, for some reason, to take this and lie and misrepresent evidence to make their case. And it will have and has had an effect on the support and the pressure that's being put on this to actually find Hayes' killer. So since they will not come on and defend their work and answer questions that I have regarding why did you say this was fact when it is not fact, and I can show you the documents, because of that, I am going to release the reply brief on the public feed. We're going to finish Luke's case here. I'm going to finish the reply brief episodes on Patreon as promised. And then I'm going to take the reply brief episodes and start releasing them on the public feed for everyone to hear. So for those of you that have been out there that have said, oh, you're hiding it behind a paywall, it's going to be out there for all the public to see. And I will go on any podcast and I will have a discussion and a debate with anybody who wants to, that wants to question the facts that I put forth in that reply brief series. Because every single thing that I'm saying in there, to the best of my ability and knowledge, is fact-checked. It is gone over with a fine-tooth comb over and over again. If I am wrong about something, I am willing to publicly have that conversation and either explain why I thought what I thought or admit that I got something wrong. But it is critically important to me that real justice is served in this case, that Adnan remains free because he absolutely 100% is an innocent man, and that's easily proven. This case is not complicated. He is very clearly and easily proven innocent, and that means that Haman Lee's killer is still out there, and I'll be damned if I'm going to sit back and let all this pressure stop her killer from being found. So that stuff is coming out in the public feed. So if you can't afford you're going to have to wait a little bit until we put them out. But if you can't afford or just don't want to pay money for those episodes, if you just wait a little bit, they are going to come on the feed. And that'll also work for us. It'll give me time when those episodes are dropping for me to prep for our next season. So that is coming along those lines because of this absolute disaster and mess that the prosecutors have created. I don't know if that's what prompted it, but it seems like all this negative pressure that's been put out there. We finally hear from Adnan, and he did a press conference today. And Janet, I'll let you quickly talk about what went on with that press conference.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. And my hope is that instead of, in the long term, instead of this being something that created a tremendous amount of stress and negativity and vitriol and poison and hate spewed in the direction of a family and families that have already gone through so much, I hope that in the long term, this actually does something good, because at the end of the day, it's still shining a light on the truth. And if you try to obscure that and make a lot of noise about it, eventually the light's still on. So that dirt is going to wash away. And I hope that Adnan feels good about, and his family feels good about, the press conference. I don't want them to feel forced into it because they've had to somehow defend themselves better or differently than they have done with their legal team in the past, that Adnan has done with the hundreds of hours of conversations that he's had with reporters in the past, including Sarah Koenig. And so from their living room, there he was, there members of his family were. His father, of course, was not there because he's ill, and so he was resting. And it was all very real. And Adnan, I thought, this is all, listen, when I talk about my feelings, these are my feelings. I know he's innocent. Say what you will. My feelings are, he represented himself very, very well. I thought he came off so well spoken, so well presented. He very clearly laid out the kind of miscarriage of justice that was occurring from day one of the trial, from the racist behavior of the prosecutor's office to the miscarriage of age problems that then didn't get corrected, and he just stayed in jail and then prison. And then he did, very similarly to what you did, and I saw that you shouted this out too, just a few moments ago. I'm trying to remember, Anna, there you are, Anna, that he listed off all the judges that said that he did not get a fair trial, perhaps in response to some people wagging their tongues about the idea that he got a fair trial. He was like, let me go ahead and outline for you all of the judges who get their jobs because they're qualified, but
all seven judges.
All seven judges who found in favor of Adnan not having gotten a fair trial. So this is not something that's just like the opinion of a few lay people and the real experts know that it was fair. It's not a cop out. It's not a cop out. So anyway, he was able to address that. He played some video of Kevin Urich and they implored the attorney general to investigate the prosecutorial misconduct at minimum of Kevin Urich. It is provable. They have another person who is coming forward with an affidavit proving from their evidence that Kevin Urich lied. So they're getting even more information out into the world that someone else who's extremely credible, who has not yet been named, is supplying evidence that he lied and falsified non-facts to railroad this case. I guess that sounds crazy unless you can prove that it happened, and you can. So that was his opportunity. And then he took some questions from the press. The press, I thought, asked some really interesting questions. They asked if he was prepared to go back to prison if he had to. He said he would respect the law in that way and that he would be with people that he deeply cares about, but he is very worried about his family and what it will do to them. He spoke about believing very strongly in victims' rights with respect to Hayes' family and all other victims' families, and trying to find that balance, but also understanding that the law needs to represent all parties in a fair and balanced way, and that this has gone in a direction that puts his own family in a sort of jeopardy. And so they are saying, we will not get justice for Hay if all of this parliamentary conversation, I say that with all respect to Hay's family, I truly do, if all of this pulls away the focus, which was the prosecution has zero case. They themselves, their office in the state of Maryland, says they have nothing. Then why aren't we focusing on who did this? Exactly. So that is what we are asking. Hold the people who are keeping that from happening, hold them responsible. Hold them responsible for not bringing a killer to justice and for putting someone else in prison. And find the person who did it. Do your jobs. Stop making it about covering up your colleagues. Sorry.
Amen. I want to reply quickly to Chris in the YouTube chat. Who says she hasn't listened to the prosecutor, but she said, I'm saying they lied. Haven't they analyzed, speaking of the prosecutor's podcast, haven't they analyzed the same evidence as you and just came to a different conclusion? Chris, so yes, they analyzed the same evidence as me. The problem is they lied and misrepresented what that evidence said in order to get to a conclusion that seems to be preconceived. Quick example. This is one of literally dozens that I point out. In the episode that I'm covering in tomorrow, which will be this Wednesday, will be the next reply brief episode. They said, Jay says that he took Adnan back to track practice about 4 o'clock because that's when track practice started. So they say things like that and they get people to be like, oh yeah. And then they make a point how, yeah, of course Adnan was at track practice. He was creating an alibi. The problem is that's not at all what Jay said. Jay said that after they dropped off Hayes' car, that they drove around, went to the other side of town to Patapsco State Park, and they smoked weed while watching the sunset over the cliff. Sunset was at 5:05 p.m. And then after that, he took him back to track to make an appearance. So it's things like that. They have the evidence, but they're just making shit up in order to make their narrative fit. That's not in the evidence. They're not even cherry picking. In many cases, they're only like pulling out part of a statement to try to make something work. But in other cases like that, they are quite literally just making something up and straight up lying about what the record says. So it's not about their opinions. It's not about their conclusions. The problem is that they are intentionally misrepresenting facts. At least in my opinion, it very much appears to be intentional. I don't know how it can't be when they quote line one from a document, line five from a document, and line 10 from a document, and they don't tell you about lines 3, 4, 6, 8 that all contradict what they're saying. They skip over them. That seems very intentional to me. But with that being said, Janet, thank you very much for not only your recap, but I love the passion, and this is why we're here. I think it comes through pretty clear, I hope, for anybody that's hearing this, why I'm doing what I'm doing with the Anon case and why Janet is here volunteering every week to do this work. This isn't a game for us. This is something that we are truly passionate about, and that's why we're here. And we're going to, I would love to talk about this for another hour, but we don't have time because at the same time that all this is going on, we got a bombshell of a brief filed in the Delphi case by Richard Allen's defense. I read it last night and then sent it over to Zach, and he read it, and Zach has thoroughly researched. So I'll let Zach explain what was written about in that reply brief. One thing I'll tell you before he starts real quick, remember what we've been hearing for all these years in that case was that there was a very specific signature at the crime scene. We always heard about the signature, but they would never told us what the signature was. Now we know what it is.
So to start, what this was is that the defense dropped a motion for Frank's hearing, which essentially says that they illegally obtained a search warrant for Richard Allen, their client, based on the fact that there is exculpatory evidence out there for him that could prove that he did not do this. Now, we all have our spots where we stand on this. That's not what I'm talking about at the moment. This is just what the document says. So in the document, if you haven't read it, it is extremely graphic in portions. So
content advisory, yeah.
Yeah, content advisory. I'm not going to get too crazy and talking about it. You can go read it for yourselves. But one thing we know is that it has never been released what the crime scene looked like or what the bodies look like. We just recently found out the way that they were killed. But in this document, they lay out specifically how everything is laid out on the crime scene, including the bodies, the positioning of the bodies. The way the crime scene, it's graphic, and I'm trying to hold back on saying anything too crazy, but what we now know is that the signatures that have been left are sticks that have been freshly cut and formed in the shape of runes, of Nordic runes, and placed on the bodies, which is a whole nother realm that we haven't dove into yet. I mean, this
real is... Real quickly, can you explain what you mean by runes?
So in the Nordic culture, they're letters, they're symbols that mean different things. This all kind of goes back to the Nordic culture. There's a religion called Odinism that becomes a big part of this that we're moving forward into. So what it is these symbols that mean different things, just like in every other, I don't know what you want to call it, every other religion, they all have symbols and meanings. So on the bodies, there are sticks that are freshly cut and formed onto the body that shaped these runes. We have never heard this before. We don't know anything about this. But the big thing is it looks like it's premeditated because these sticks have been cut clean. They're not broken off. Another big portion of this is this Odinism idea. And I know that, you know, we've discussed it off the air a little bit, but that there is this religious sect that's considered Odinism. Their members are Odinites. That has seemed to be kind of taken over by white supremacists. At least that's what the defense is trying to say here. And what we now know is that Abby's boyfriend or ex-boyfriend's father is part of this religion. And the document just kind of continues to build off of the idea that that Abby's boyfriend / ex-boyfriend's father could be the culprit. There is a lot of evidence pointing in that direction. I'm not going to get, like I said, I don't want to get too, because it's really graphic. We've talked about it.
Well, I'll talk a little bit about some of it. And here's your trigger warning. You're going to skip ahead a few minutes because I think it's important to share some of these details. And I get why Zach's not wanting to, but so.
And this is all alleged. I just want to, Kate, I see you. Yeah. I see you in there. If the defense is making this up whole cloth, we will have a feast to talk about next week because that would be insane. But it is absolutely alleged. That is very fair.
So everything that we're sharing right now, we're just quoting what was in this document by the defense. In that document, they are referencing the police file, but we haven't seen the police file. So essentially, you have sticks, branches from trees that were, as Zach mentioned, were cleanly cut, which is interesting. They weren't broken off of trees, which means either the sticks were brought to the scene or there was a saw brought to the scene. in order to do this. Without getting too graphic about the bodies, Libby was found nude. Abby was found clothed. Their bodies were positioned in a particular way, and Libby's throat had been slit, according to this document. I don't remember what it said about Abby's cause of death.
Abby's cause of death was the same, but they believe that she was, when she was murdered, they believe that she was nude because her clothes have no blood on them.
And then reclothed.
And reclothed.
So these sticks that are cleanly cut are placed into these symbols, are very carefully laid out in symbols. They were described as being painted. The sticks were painted, according to this document, with Libby's blood. There's a tree right by in the way Libby's body was positioned, way like her hand was, is kind of pointing towards, is that right, a tree? And on that tree, one of these Nordic symbols are painted on the tree in Libby's blood also. That is, according to this document, that is the signature that they've been talking about all this time. It's also revealed in this document that the FBI Behavioral Analysis Unit profiled the scene, which we knew. We didn't know anything about the profile. Evidently, the profile said that the killer, and I don't know if it was single or plural, but that they would have ties to this Odinite religion, or Odinism religion, or Odinite cult. Ritualistic. This is not like, from what they're describing, this is not like West Memphis 3, where bodies are brought out. We know now that they were just chewed on by turtles, but they see these injuries and they think, oh, this must be a ritualistic. This was very carefully and specifically, these symbols were placed on the bodies in a very clear way. It either was a ritualistic killing from what they're describing, or it was made to look like a Odinite ritualistic killing.
Now, the big thing in the document is they are trying to, the document is trying to make you believe that there is no way possible that a single person could do this. And if this is stated as fact and true, I mean, it does seem unlikely that a single person would be able to do everything that it's done in the time period that they had to do with the murder.
Yeah.
It's because there's a very short, you know, there's only about an hour window.
Right. And remember, when Richard Allen was arrested, we were told that there could be or likely is someone else still. Even more upsetting if it's true, according to this document, this all came to light because the defense has been asking for discovery from the prosecution. Now, this, I know you're thinking, because we're all trained in this Brady. It's not Brady yet because the trial hasn't happened yet, but they've been asking for discovery for everything the state has, and they didn't have anything about this stuff. There was evidently a team of detectives who were named in the document who had been working, investigating this angle for some time. They are the ones that had narrowed down on four suspects, one of whom was the person that Zach mentioned. Is, we're not going to name them because even though the names are public, these are unarrested, unindicted citizens, so we're not going to name them. But that person is Abby's boyfriend or ex-boyfriend's father, who is a part of this religion. According to this document, within a couple of days after the murders, that individual made a social media post as a picture of sticks placed on the ground, I believe, in the exact symbols that were found on Libby and Abby's bodies. There's, again, a connection between him and three other people. There are, Zach has these details, he wants to share them, but there are reports that there have been some admissions made by these folks to family members and friends. You want to talk a little bit about that?
So there is the individual in question, we're going to call BH, which is Abby's boyfriend / ex-boyfriend's dad. At one point, he was friends with another gentleman, we'll call PW, who lived 3.1 miles away from the cemetery, about a 7-minute drive. And they would hang out all the time. It's known that they would go have these rituals on Sundays. I know the murder didn't occur on a Sunday, but they would go have these rituals on Sundays, pretty well known. They were friends, and I've looked it up on Facebook. It says in the record, I've seen it on Facebook myself. There are photos of them together as of late January mm-hmm. of that year. It says they were no longer friends by the end of February, and BH's wife, now ex-wife, says, I don't have the quote pulled up, but essentially says that there was something happened at a ritual that they were down by a river by PW's house. Something happened or was said and they no longer get along. And it was all involving a ritual. So, I mean, if that is true, that's a very strange thing to have happen.
Right.
There's another individual that lives about 100 miles away that has confessed to it. We're going to call him EF. He confessed to his sister saying that he was on the bridge, that he was with these guys. He has connections back to these other two individuals. At one point was questioned by police and when was released, this is not on record. They actually have record of him talking to police, but off the record after he was released, it is said that he turned around and asked the officer, if my spit is on them and I have a good reason, am I still in trouble? Which is very weird and damning if that is true.
Right.
There's a few more individuals, but they all kind of tie back to the one, the BH individual, which is Abby's boyfriend / ex-boyfriend's dad.
Yeah. And there's more to it than that. There's some other weird connections that we'll get into later to answer. And I see Kate keep putting in there allegedly. Again, everything we're saying is we're only quoting what was put in the defense document.
And I will go out and say, I mean, I said this to Bob. I don't know if I said this to Jan, but they did a very good job at making compelling arguments.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's true or not, but they did a phenomenal job making compelling arguments towards this.
Yeah. And that said, I want to point out, like, when I read it, I was like, holy crap, this is, I mean, there's some pretty, again, if this stuff is true, the cut sticks, all that stuff, there's a whole lot here that looked real bad. I'm really waiting to pass any judgment until we get a reply brief from the prosecution, because, you know, as we've been talking about, prosecutors are only going to present the prosecution case and defense is only going to present the defense case. We may get a reply brief from the prosecution that is like, yeah, that's not what happened. Here's the real fact, blah, 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 blah. And this all gets straightened out. But it looks extremely, extremely compelling to me. It's confusing because the other thing you got to get past is that Richard Allen admitted that he was on the bridge or that he was there at that time. He has a blue jacket. He has allegedly confessed on a recorded line to his wife multiple times since he's been in jail. There's of course the firearms evidence, which I just don't, you know, I don't put much weight into that type of firearm comparison. So there seems to be a lot there with Richard Allen too. To answer somebody else's question, if Richard Allen has any connection to these guys, according to this document, according to the defense, he has no connection to these people or this religion.
Yeah, this is all interesting. I mean, Kate, I saw your comment further back that you said this could potentially be sort of dirtying a jury pool. And I think that's something to keep in mind. You know, we if you are sort of falling on the side often of criminal justice reform and wrongful convictions, then a lot of the time you look at the way the prosecution addresses the press or the public and or the police do. And you say, well, look, you know, they are spilling all of this quote unquote information, quote unquote evidence in advance to sort of set the tone for what they would like the direction they want it to go. And it can be done on the side of the defense as well. So we all just, yeah. I think we're all kind of coming from the same place where everything has to be taken with a serious grain of salt. And you're right, Kate, you know, we can't make any, no one should be taking any of this to the place of a decision or an opinion, but it's very difficult because this is such an emotional case and it's such an upsetting case. And what the defense has released is extremely disturbing and infuriating in terms of, you know, the treatment of these children. And so we all need to be very careful.
Yeah. And I just realized based on some of these comments on here, that I didn't really finish my thought about this team of detectives. So that's how this came to light, according to this document, is this team of detectives that were working on this angle. They had identified these suspects. They really felt they were onto something. They had allegedly turned all this over to the prosecution and were looking for an arrest or, you know, to continue on further. Everything they found with the, you know, that we just talked about, plus the fact of that the FBI profile seems to absolutely line up with this, it's a very specific signature. And they said all of a sudden, they arrest some other guy and they're kind of like, who's this guy? We don't know who this guy is. the defense had been requesting all this stuff in discovery. They weren't given any of this. And it sounds like those detectives or one of those detectives shared this information with the defense. And that's when it all came out.
Yeah.
The other connection that I guess is worth pointing out, since I did point out that allegedly Richard Allen has confessed to his lawyers or his guards, whatever, at prison recorded lines. One of those connections is that some of these guys that are part of this Odinite religion and have ties, they're all connected to the suspects, work at that jail as guards. And so they're, you know, alleging that the guards there, who they're claiming are the actual killers, are, you know, forced, you know, basically beat and deprived Richard Allen and forced him to make those admissions. So there's a whole lot here. I don't know if there's anything else you want to touch on, Zach.
So this is where I come in with the bullshit flag. So I'm not saying that that this is true or false, but this is where the bullshit flag comes into me, is they discuss that these guys have all this Viking Nordic apparel. They have these clothes. They have these patches that say Odin. They have the interlocking triangle patches. They have interlocking triangle t-shirts. Well, guess what? I have multiple too, and I'm not one of them.
Yeah.
And I know hundreds of friends that have shirts like this. I have clients that I've tattooed Nordic symbols on, mm-hmm. Nordic calendars on. I mean, this is where it becomes like, is this truly something? Or is this just something they're latching onto? We've seen it in the West Memphis 3 with the Satanic Panic. We've seen it, and we're talking about the Luke Mitchell case.
Yeah.
And they literally pushed the same shit in the Luke Mitchell case. So is this true, or is this some new thing that they're trying to push in defense?
Answer me this, because maybe I'm confused about it. Was it just that they had those symbols and stuff on their, because they had like patches, they said, on their uniform, or was it some of those actual guys? I thought that some of those actual suspects were guards.
No, none of these suspects were guards.
None of those are, okay.
Nope, the guards had patches that said, "In Odin we trust." And they also had another patch that had the interlocking triangles with an American flag.
Mm-hmm.
And in my opinion, and in my world that I've seen, there are a lot of ex-military that fall into this. They like this idea. They like this warrior mentality, this stand on your feet, don't live on your knees. That's kind of their motto that comes along. So while I'm not saying it's true, I'm not saying it's false, I just think that, you know, this is the same thing as saying Luke Mitchell killed somebody because he liked Marilyn Manson.
I don't think it's the same, in my opinion. Because of the fact that we're not trying to make some inferences. Those symbols, according to this document, if it's true, those symbols were very intentionally placed on the body. So to me, it's either someone who truly believes that or someone who intentionally made it look that way, which is a little different than Luke Mitchell going, "Her body was like this." That's kind of similar to Black Dahlia. He had a ripped poster of Marilyn Manson, and therefore he did this to try to recreate Black. To me, that's different than seeing a crime scene with these symbols actually placed on the bodies and painted on the tree and stuff.
Mm-hmm. But what I'm getting, I guess, is the pressure from the guards, that people are relaying that there's pressure from the guards, that just because they have this symbol, you know, I mean, I don't know. I have a hard time with that part.
Yeah. And I don't know. Again, all that's just what we have now. We will continue to keep you updated as more comes in. I don't know what the timeline is. Typically, in cases like this, when the defense files a motion, usually the prosecution will be given anywhere from 2 weeks to 30 days to 60 days to reply. So I'll be very interested to see the reply brief from the prosecution. And we should probably hold off all, you know, any judgment on it until we hear the other side of the story.
Yes, indeed. What a day.
Yeah, busy day. And with that, we should get into, you said you've got a bunch of questions.
Yeah.
Real quick, before we get into the questions, Zach and I were talking about this off the air before we started. This case is, I see now, without having known before, why I've never done an international case before, particularly from the UK, because, geez, Louise, this is so hard. So Zach has done a ton of research into this case. I've obviously done a ton of research in this case. And we're sitting here talking, and it's like, yeah, every element of this, there's 10 different sources that you can read that tell you 10 different versions of events, and none of them are linked to a source document because none of the source documents are available.
Yeah.
So I just want to preface answering these questions with, a lot of these answers may be that I don't really know. I can only get, and I'm glad Zach's here this week because he has researched a lot of it too. So what I may answer is what I thought was fact based on what I found. He may have found something that says something different. So we'll do our best to get through these. And obviously we're going to continue giving as much information as we can about this case over these next couple of weeks to finish, to tell the story and put the awareness out there. But man, this is, I've never worked on a case without source documents before, and it is a challenge.
Yeah.
And it's crazy that the idea that you said there's no source documents. And as you said before, there's all these reports, but you can, I mean, every report you read is crazily biased. Either there seems to be no neutrality in this case whatsoever, which is just baffling to me.
Yeah. Most of the information we have out there with the documentaries that are out there and some of the podcasts, there was a book written, and I believe it's the same person that did the documentary, or at least was in the documentary. That person, I guess, was given access to the defense file. So like they had some source documents because the people who believe Luke is guilty will say, well, yeah, it's the defense file. So they're giving you a defense because a documentary very clearly makes Luke look innocent. But even that was not like, it seems like she was given access to it enough to write the book and to, work in the documentary, but wasn't allowed to share. She quotes stuff, right? So like in the book, they'll be, it says in, from Luke's interview, quote, dot, 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 dot. So we have that quote, but we don't have the whole document. So that's just me saying, if I say I don't know a whole bunch of times, that's why. Go ahead, Janet.
It may come to that. Well, yeah, I mean, you just may not know. Because, when I was listening to it, I definitely had questions come up about the timeline. And I know that there are things you're going to get a little further into, and then there are things that probably we just don't even know the answers to. But so there's stuff along those lines, and people hoping to get some more information about some of the pieces that I know that you're going to get into in future episodes. But so you can also say, that's still coming. But technically, it's not rushing ahead because these are questions that are genuinely generated from this episode. But let's go big picture for a second. Jenna says, if Luke was sentenced to 20 years and it's been about 20 years, is there a chance he's getting out soon no matter where he is, or is he stuck in the situation where he would have to essentially admit guilt in order to be released?
I saw this question and I haven't had time to go back and research, but my understanding was that he was given a life sentence and he's eligible for parole in 20 years. So someone can correct me if I'm wrong about that, but I don't believe it was a 20-year sentence, because what I've heard Luke speaking directly about it and some of the documentaries and stuff, he said that, he probably could, if he admitted wrongdoing and showed remorse, that he could get that parole. He can't get parole until 20 years, which would be coming up next year, I think. So yeah, I think the 20 years is when he would be eligible for parole. And he has stated that if what it will take is for him to say that he did this, then he'll just stay in prison for the rest of his life because he refuses to confess to something that he didn't do.
Okay. Brian says, can or could anything be recovered from the phones whose messages were deleted? And there's another question about texts as well, which is just, wow, is there really no way of... Sue says, I don't have an in-depth knowledge of cell phone technology, especially back then, but can't law enforcement get the text messages from the service provider even when they've been deleted from the phones? So a couple questions around the phones there.
Well, not now, but in 2003, they could have. You also had something I hadn't thought about until literally just this moment. This is 2003.
Right.
This is old school texting.
Yeah.
This is like new tech. Like, I didn't send my first text message ever until 2006.
Yeah.
I got one and was like, what is this? Didn't know what it was on my Nextel flip phone.
Right.
So this is 3 years before that. This is the press the 2 button 3 times to get to the C and the kind of texting.
Oof. So I not vaguely, that was totally the wrong word. I for sure know about 2003. That's the year I graduated. So I remember this distinctly.
Uh-huh.
When we text, it was 10 cents a text too. Like, yeah. I remember that. Bad. Like, it wasn't the free texting that we have now. It wasn't willy-nilly, you could just do whatever. It was hit the button a bunch of times.
Yeah. And so I'm saying that to say this, because a lot of people have asked, like, you know, what was the conversation? Lucas said there was no planned time. He said that the text that he got back from her just said, I'll be by later or be along later or something. That worth, I think we may be in the mindset thinking of iPhones where we can very clearly and easily type out our whole message, like, okay, well, I'm going to finish eating dinner. I'll head down Rhone's Dyke and I'll meet you at your house around 5:45 if that works. That wasn't happening on these phones. It would have been like, okay,
right,
be there later, something similar to that. As far as the stuff recovered, again, this is a huge black hole. So from what the documents that I've been able to see found, which are just a reference to a document, are that Luke's texts were deleted. We're going to get into some more this week, but at 11:55, he's taken into police custody. He doesn't get sent home until 6 a.m. He's there all night. The expert testified at trial that he could tell that the texts were deleted off the phone sometime after 12:30 a.m., which the police had it in their possession then. That's just weird thing number one, right? Then we're just told the texts were also not available. They had been deleted off of Judith's phone, but nobody knows. Like it's just one of those things. Like, how is this not out there somewhere? Was there an interview where they discussed it? Was there a forensic examination of the phone? That's what I have from every source I've been able to find. Zach, I don't know if you find anything different, but all I've been able to find is the texts were deleted off the phone. No one knows how.
Everything I've seen is the texts are gone. No one knows how. Honestly, when you said that they were deleted at 12:30, that's the first time I'd ever heard that. I've honestly never heard that or seen that.
Well,
doesn't mean it's not true. I just haven't seen that. But yeah, that's all I see is the texts are gone. No one knows why or how.
Is there evidence that the texts were there for anyone ever to see beyond Jody, who we assume is Jody, and Luke texting? Because if you're using your mom's phone and you say something like, can't wait to do a little something, something with you and the something, then you both would just erase your texts right afterwards. Because you're like, I don't want Jody's mom. I don't want my mom reading this thing I texted. And then he would be like, oh, I don't want, like, that's private or whatever.
So that was my thought was, Jody's texting from her mother's phone. So
yeah.
I could see that maybe Jody would delete the text.
Yeah.
Because whatever was said doesn't want mom to see it.
Right.
We know Luke didn't do that. Based on what has been cited is that he didn't delete his text because that was his personal phone.
Right.
They were deleted after 12:30 when the phone was in the police possession.
So somewhere there's information where people other than Luke say, I saw Luke's phone and I saw those texts.
Should be.
We don't know.
Yeah.
Does it say after 12:30 or at 12:30?
So the book that's being quoted in, I don't have the name of the book in front of me right now. I believe the author is Dr. Sandra Jean. That's the person that had access, I believe, to the defense files and quoted all this stuff. So that's where, from that book is where we hear that at the trial, the expert testified that the texts were deleted sometime after 12:30 a.m. So that's all I know.
Okay. Aaliyah says, from and until what time was Luke playing with his friends at the Abbey? Do his friend's statements say he was acting normal during this time?
I don't have the exact details on that time yet, because that's what I'm going to be covering some more of this week or next week when we get into kind of the case for innocence. There were witnesses that saw him. Remember, Luke said that he was sitting on the wall waiting for Jody to show up. There are, I believe, two different witnesses that saw him sitting on that wall for like 20 minutes. Like, they saw him, that not that he was there for 20 minutes, but they saw him there for 20 minutes. And then there are the witnesses, the people that he was hanging out with at the Abbey were also interviewed. I know that they had said, just off the top of my head, without digging into it like I do for an episode, that he didn't have any blood on him or anything. And Jody, we're going to get into this week too, but like, so Jody's throat was slit. Like, her carotid and jugular were both slit, which is a massive spray of blood. When you cut your carotid artery, there's a lot of blood. It goes a lot of places. There's some other weird stuff about the crime scene we'll get into. But the time 7 o'clock is sticking in my head. I don't know if that was the time he left or that was the time he got there. But somehow, I believe with a window on both sides for a period of time, at 7 o'clock he was at the Abbey. But yeah, it sounds like that everything was normal and he didn't have any blood on him. Also should be pointed out that he was taken in the night. I mentioned this in the first episode. We'll get into it in more detail later. But, you know, another weird thing is, you know, so he was, again, they find the body. He was immediately taken in a police car to the police station and was from the discovery of the body until 6 a.m. He was tested forensically. He was stripped down. He was put in a white suit. And it was noted that his hair was dirty. There's dirt under his fingernails. He hadn't taken a shower or anything like that. And there was no DNA from Jody on him. There's no blood on him, anything like that. Next week, we're going to get into what the prosecution's case is. So we'll talk about the elements that don't look so good for him. But that's kind of one of the ones that it's kind of hard to get around.
Yeah, I'm fascinated to hear more about the different sightings and how some of that seemed more ambiguous was what they went with, when some of it that seems like it's people who knew him and it's impossible for him to have been in two places at once. Like how that side was like, that was thrown away. But we always say that.
Yeah, well, there's so much of this. So there's thing one, we don't have the source documents. Thing two is all these changing stories, not by Luke, but by the victim's family. It's bananas. Like you can't track anything because, like I said, like her mom gave 12 statements in a month. And they're all conflicting and change, and the times change, and then when she's grounded changes, and all this stuff changes. And so it's really difficult to try. I definitely spend a lot of time with my head spinning, like, especially when, like, you know, these episodes are short because, number one, there's not a lot of information, otherwise I would give it to you, and number two, I'm having this constant juggling match with myself, like, I don't, like, is it ethical for me to say this? Because, yeah, I have somebody saying that they saw a document and they're saying it, but I don't know that for sure.
Yeah.
Thank you, Valeria. The book that I was referencing earlier is called Innocence Betrayed, and it is by Dr. Sandra Lean, not Jean. Dr. Sandra Lean, Innocence Betrayed. And she is the one that had, you know, she wrote that book. It's kind of considered, from what I've been told, kind of it's the holy grail of this case. That's the, where most information, actual factual information, comes from that book, because she had access to the defense file.
And even without access to the defense files, were there not journalists? I mean, perhaps some of you who are across the pond, as it were, know this better, but like at the time, contemporaneously, wouldn't have there been journalists, even if there's no recordings or anything that's allowed to be released to the public? Is the press not allowed to report on the actual ins and outs of how a case is being tried? Or is that like all secret?
But this goes back to what we started on, the biases of the reporting. There are reporters and they're reporting about this case, but they're only reporting their side of it. The people that think they're guilty are only going back and reporting what they're saying that makes Luke guilty. The innocent people are only going back and reporting what makes him look innocent.
Right. But I'm saying, but weren't there people there at the time that were like, I am a person who doesn't, you know, who has just been following the case. I'm a reporter for X newspaper in Edinburgh, and I've shown up from Edinburgh, and I'm just saying, then the judge ruled this. Then the prosecution made today's proceedings were that took this shape. This is who testified. This is who said what. Like, that seems like it would be the most trustworthy, because it's like, I'm literally saying, I just took shorthand notes of everything that happened that day procedurally.
Yeah, I think some of that does exist, because I've seen some of that stuff. But it's not reported like it is here in the U.S., where, like, you know, where you're getting like a blow by blow. You're getting kind of what Zach's talking about. And remember, Luke was kind of convicted in the court of public opinion. Very much West Memphis 3-esque, mm-hmm. You know, where it was like, he's a Satanist and this was a Black Dahlia killing. And so that was the story. That was the narrative they were all running with before the trial happened. And then they would kind of give a summation of what was happening, but it was all geared kind of in that direction. Mm-hmm. But it's not all that way. Cause I read, it was in an article, one of those types of articles where they said the witness who had seen the young couple at the entrance of the path had, you know, at trial, not been able to identify Luke as one of those people, you know, so mm-hmm. some of that's out there, but it's just not in depth. As a matter of fact, Donna, I mentioned, the person that I've been, that's been helping me a lot with, you know, trying to piece all this stuff together. she had said she just realized that things are different in the U.S. because she I think she was wondering, like, why am I she's like, well, this happened. I'm like, where's the source document? Where am I getting this?
Yeah.
And I think she was like, what is this guy doing? And then she's like, she has a friend that lives in the U.S. and she's like, I had no idea that you guys can just get files. Like, we can't get files. Like, you have all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of seems like it's kind of par for the course over there to be dealing with limited information, as opposed to here, where for the most part, we can get access to all that stuff.
Understood.
Well, and it sounds like from the people I've talked to, the people that lived in that area that heard about the case in real time, everybody thought he was guilty. I mean, absolutely everybody thought he was guilty. This notion that he is wrongfully convicted and innocent is more like in the last 5 to 10 years. Like, it wasn't at the time. I mean, I'm sure that there are people that stood by him at the time, but it felt like it was generally received that he was guilty at that time by everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. And to answer your question, Pamela had asked if I've reached out to Dr. Lean. I have not yet. So I've got a contact I'm working with that's citing the source material from Dr. Lean's book. And then what I want to do is then, when we kind of wrap things up, I want to see if I can get Dr. Lean to come on for an interview and probably correct a lot of the stuff that I put out there. I've never felt less confident about.
I appreciate you being honest about that.
And after you've heard my whole speech at the beginning of this, I don't like that very much at all. That I haven't been able to source all of this material. So I very much want to bring on, if she's willing, Dr. Lean to come on and kind of share her thoughts, and then also to correct anything that I have got wrong. Because the last thing I want to do is be putting out misinformation about a case. So I want to make sure that we do our best with someone who knows the most to kind of fact check me throughout this process.
Got it.
And I do know that she's listening. So Matt Elliott, I had talked about, who kind of put me in contact with Donna. I think he has either contact directly with Dr. Sandrine or through somebody else. Then he had shared like some comments that she had had about, you know, in that very first episode, I put stuff out that I was reading, and she's like, nah, that stuff's not true. So she obviously had listened. So hopefully she's keeping up and hearing this and knowing that I'll be reaching out and hopefully getting Dr. Lean to come on and do an interview.
Great. Okay. With that in mind, I just want to honor these questions because I think they're really good questions. So even if we don't have answers, I feel like a lot of people probably had similar questions. So let's just get through a few more. Tracy says, how did Alice manage to be at the entrance of the path to meet Luke with Janice and Steven at 11:10 when she was on the phone with Judith at 11:03 and lives approximately 25 minutes away? And you did kind of talk about this stuff in terms of like, how is this physically possible? Did Judith call her mother's landline or was it a mobile phone? I'm very curious, and this is almost a separate thought, at least that is for me. I'm very curious who made the 10:45 call to the police. I mean, you dropped that little breadcrumb and I'm sure so many of us were like, wait, what?
Yeah. So just to remind everybody, Alice is the grandmother. I don't, as I said in the episode, it doesn't make any sense to me at all. Like, if she's home in Mayfield at 11:03, how is she at the entrance to Ronsdyke Path in East Houses at 11:10? I don't know that the way it was posed to me was that the call was to the landline. So then, you know, there were questions like, did they catch a cab? It was kind of said that they had walked, but did they catch a cab? Did they catch a ride up there? I don't know. And then that 10:45 call, that was another one. I'm like, so here's all this information and it's all stated as it's verified fact. I haven't seen the document from it, but like the timing of that call. So someone calls and says that they're Judith, but then we can see from the phone record, Judith was on the phone to someone else at that time. I
is fascinating and incredibly frustrating.
And I wonder if it's, I don't know. So, because I've thought a lot about it and it's like, well, is it something like she's calling grandma, puts her husband on the phone to talk to grandma, and then she grabs the cell phone and calls the police or vice versa? I don't know, but there should be record of those calls.
Or just like a clerical error where someone wrote somewhere that she called at X time and people were like, wait, that's impossible. And they're actually talking about the same call. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know?
I have no idea.
Okay.
Thank you.
Kathy says, have other crimes been committed on the path before or after her death? Were there any other child murders or attacks in 100-mile radius in the recent years before or after her death?
That's a great question. I don't know the answer to it, but I'll try to find the answer to it.
Okay. Chris says, what is the burden of proof in Scotland as compared to the U.S.'s innocent until proven beyond a shadow of doubt or reasonable doubt?
Yeah, reasonable doubt. I don't know, because someone had pointed out that, you know, U.S. law was based on English law, but then someone else pointed out that Scottish law is not based on English. It's separate from English law. So that's another good question to try to figure out. I don't know.
The one thing I heard too, and I don't know if this is true, but it's their jury goes by majority. So the majority wins.
So it's not unanimous.
It's not unanimous like it is here. The majority, if it's 8-4, that's guilty. It's guilty. Like there is no.
Well, that explains why they might have only taken 5 hours when it was such a long case. Because that's a real. Yeah. That's always. That can mean any number of things, but it's always for those of us who are concerned about wrongful convictions. You hear that this case went on and on and on and on, and then 5 hours later they were like, yep, did it. It can take what it takes, but if you know that not everybody has to agree and you don't have to talk through it and come to a unanimous decision, then maybe it's as simple as, you know.
If they had 12 jurors, if all of a sudden they got 7 to vote yes,
yeah,
then it's over.
Like, oh, bye.
And Rebecca in the chat just said that not proven is another option for a verdict in Scotland law.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, so guilty, not guilty, and not proven.
Really interesting. Okay. One question I had that I didn't see come up here from the timeline that you gave was, I know that it's Luke's testimony, or that he, you know, one question, he said that the conversation that he had with Alan at that time, that is reflected in the phone records, when Alan said, oh, she just left, does Alan have any, like, what does Alan say that call was?
So I asked that question today, trying to clear that up. And what the defense seems to have raised about that call is that Luke says that Alan said they've just left, meaning that Jody left with someone else.
Wait, Luke says that?
That's what Luke says. And I didn't catch that he had said they've just left.
Oh, my. Okay.
So that was the angle they were taking, was she had left with someone else. That's probably the person that killed her. Right. She left with someone. And from what I was told, Alan has never confirmed or denied whether he said they or she, but it sounds like he has never denied that the conversation happened and they said that at least she had just left.
Right. Okay.
So that part seems to be confirmed.
Okay. Mike says, I only know about this case from what the first two episodes of yours have revealed. I am sure there's good reason not to consider her family's involvement in this crime, but all the story changes have me questioning them. Well, Mike says, how have you ruled them out? I'm guessing probably you.
I haven't. I don't have it's funny because Zach had been doing, you know, Zach was gone for a couple of weeks, but he's been doing a ton of research. And he said, I might have a different opinion than you guys. And I said,
I can't have
a different opinion than me because I don't have one yet. I'm still, there's too many unknowns. So I haven't ruled her family out. I certainly don't want to cast suspicions. I'll tell you that there's definitely a lot of, from what I've seen, of the people that believe that Luke is innocent. That is their theory. And we will get into that stuff later.
Yeah. A lot of the stuff I have to talk about, I feel like, is going to come in next week's episode.
Yeah. Yeah. Because Zach has done quite a bit of research on it. But yeah, I mean, so the Luke is innocent crowd, most of them, from what I've seen, think that some people in the family have had something to do with her murder. And I'll just say this. If what they're saying is true about the evidence and things that are found, they've got good reason to maybe at least suspect that.
I agree. I agree wholeheartedly.
Well, that'll be really interesting to talk about, because that's, you know, you made the comparison with Jay just in terms of trying to, you know, understand changing stories. And
yeah.
The thing that we saw that was present in all of those changing stories for Jay seemed to be law enforcement. So Is it a situation in which someone says, broken, and I don't know anything about this case, again, other than, you know, the handful of things, but if law enforcement says, we know for a fact that he did do it, you got to help us out on some of this. Like, are the stories changing after meetings with law enforcement? That
was the first thing I thought.
Yeah.
When they say she left at 5:30. And then they get a witness that says, well, between 4:54 and 4:59, I saw a young couple that might have been Luke and her at the entrance of this path. Is it possible to a grieving family to be like, are you sure that she didn't leave at like 4:50? Yeah. I don't know. Maybe it's not difficult to plant that seed in someone who's grieving.
Sure.
So on a timeline issue or a thing that we haven't brought up, there is a 4:54 call that Luke makes to the talking clock, which is a service that tells you what time it is, which I find is a very interesting phone call.
Yeah. It's like what if you're old enough, like Janet and I, you remember when you used to call time to see what time it was. So yeah, the argument about that, and I didn't even know that wasn't in the list of calls that I was reading off of. So that was kind of news to me. When you said it, you were like, the kind of the argument is, if he was home, why would he call time? And then I remembered, well, when I used to call time, I was always at home because there were no cell phones. I don't remember why, but I would do it often. Mm-hmm. I don't remember what the number was, but you could call a number and get time. So that to me doesn't put Luke not in the house, because like I said, I have called time or the talking clock many times in my life, and every single time I was at home. Actually, every single time anyone ever called it prior to, say, 1997, they were at home because there were no cell phones.
But we're not prior to 1997. We are 2003 with cell phones, and he calls from his cell phone.
Right. I'm just saying.
But doesn't your cell phone potentially have the time on it anyway?
Should have the time on it.
So that's what's confusing about this whole phone call is why does he need to call it?
I read somewhere that he did that all the time, like that he had done that, I don't say all the time, but that was something that was consistent through days that did not, that had that nothing to do with Jody. But.
And it begs the question, in 2003, when many people have cell phones, why would anyone ever call time if the cell phones have time on it? So maybe it's just a thing.
And I don't know that it means anything. I'm just, it's there, and I'm very curious as to why.
Yeah. Also, that would be right at the exact time when the witness supposedly saw them.
Yeah.
Yeah, and as we're seeing from a lot of people in the YouTube chat, that at least in the United States, time was time and temp. You'd call and it would give you the time and temperature, maybe even the weather. But lots of people that must be around our age, Janet, you and I, know that very well. And the other thing to remember, too, I was just thinking about just right in this moment, is someone correct me if I'm wrong, but the fact now our cell phone clocks are tied into like an atomic clock. They set automatically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't believe back then that was the case. Like you had to manually set it.
It was a watch. Yeah. I think you had to be like, huh.
I agree. Huh. I do remember you have to set it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's another reason why maybe someone would call if they weren't sure their clock on their phone was right or the clock in the house was right. So anyway, we'll get into whatever your next question is.
We will, but I just want to shout out Nick, because this has come up in another case. I can't remember who it was, but it almost seemed like it could have been Adnan. But anyway, that you would call if you were expecting a call and you weren't supposed to be getting calls. If you made sure you were on the phone and you called time, that's a great way to just sit and be innocuous. And that means if you have call waiting, you get that beep and you're like, awesome. Like no one heard the phone ring.
That was Adnan's case. He said that he would do that. He would like page hey, and then he would call time and wait for her to call him.
Yeah. So interesting. Okay. Anyway, Allison has a lot of questions. I have to say, I love all of them. So I'm just going to get through them real quick. Allison says, is there any timeline information on what Jody did earlier in the day? Did she and Luke see each other at school? Any info from friends of theirs as to what was going on that day? Or is it all from the families? Also, and this is key, where does the time of death of 5:15 come from? The police or a medical examiner? That's a very specific time. Doesn't seem like something a scientist would come up with.
This is what as far as the friends know, everything I've seen is from the family. So if that stuff is out there, as far as friends at school and stuff, I haven't seen it yet. If I do find it, I will let you know. As far as the time of death, what I do know is that's impossible to determine that this happened at 5:15, particularly when you find it. But also, I didn't know until Zach just shared this with me before we went on the air today, that the medical examiner didn't examine her body until the next morning. Ugh. They couldn't get over the stone wall.
That's crazy.
And so they left her body out there unguarded, according to what, and my source on this is Zach, so blame him if it's wrong.
I've seen it multiple places.
I've read this too.
Yeah. They left her body out overnight. And that's something that, you know, obviously I would be getting into this week, and because we're going to be talking about the body and the injuries and stuff like that. But that's bananas. So I was told was that, you know, that based on the investigation and the medical examiner, they determined she was dead at 5:15. You can't differentiate between 5:15 and 5 o'clock and 6 o'clock by any sort of medical evidence like that. It just can't be done, particularly when the medical examiner didn't look at her until the next day.
And I said this because it's what I read, but multiple people have jumped in and said it rained that night.
Right. Yeah. Which also created more problems because, you know, there's blood on her body that got rent.
So that's, yeah. So that sounds like
I already don't have a whole lot of information for Sunday, and I'm already putting half of it out right now. So I should stop, or it's going to be 10 minutes.
It seems like we all agree that there's the potential there for, not unlike other cases we've seen, you have some evidence you think is compelling enough that you're going to shoehorn everything in on a timeline that actually is not, you know, based on something. Kim H says, is there any external corroboration of Jody's time for leaving home to head to the path? Any confirmed sightings by people who knew Jody or CCTV? Is the timing of the Andrina Bryson sighting confirmed? And what direction was she traveling in? I bet you'll get into some of that in a future episode, but
yeah, we'll get into that more of that later. As far as I will tell you, I haven't seen anybody that is able to confirm the Andrina sighting is the only confirmation there is. And she didn't say I saw Jody and Luke. She said I saw a young couple. If you do watch it's called Murder in a Small Town. Is that the name of the documentary?
Mm-hmm.
If you watch that, they actually recreate that sighting. And like Zach said, there's always, you know, whatever bias or spin into it. But what they did do is put the couple standing in the place where she said she saw the couple, and then they drove at the speed she said she was driving at the place she said she was driving. And you realize, and by the way, didn't know she was supposed to be looking at anything, that sighting is shaky at best. But that's the only sighting that I've seen of Jody. Well, actually, let me take that back.
I think there's something
else.
Let
me take that back.
There's a couple of
things. Oh, yeah. There's stuff that we're going to be getting
into
later.
Do you like that I
said
I didn't know anything and now I'm revealing my hand? But
yeah.
I said I don't know enough because there are people who have studied this case for a decade or more, and I don't want to. I've only recently become acquainted with it. So,
yeah. And I certainly don't know very much either. But yeah, as I was saying that, I remember, no, there was other sightings, but all the sightings have to do with that point, like when she's going into the path and who she was going into the path with.
Yeah. Then we have what I like to call a delicious batch of Teresa questions, all very good. Teresa says, I was interested in Luke's dog. He seems young to have trained a dog to track people. Without her scent to follow, would any search rescue dog just know how to smell for remains? My apologies if that sounds harsh. I'm just trying to get a better understanding of how the dog was able to know what to do.
I mean, if someone's too young to train a dog, I don't know. I mean, I had a friend when I was in middle school that was training seeing eye dog. That was her project that she was doing. So I don't think there's an age limit on when you can train a dog. As far as would they know to just, you know, look for remains? No, you have to teach them what, and I don't know that it was remains. I don't think it was remains.
I don't think it was
that
either.
She was trained to look, because he was looking for something with Jody's scent on it. So I have some experience in this because I have trained my dog to look for birds. You know, my dog Mac is my bird dog that I go bird hunting with. And it's a process of, you know, teaching them, this is the smell you're looking for. And then you hide it, and then they find it, and then you reward them. And then pretty soon they pick up on, oh, that's the thing that you want me to find. So it can certainly be done. And dogs are smart.
Teresa, I see your comment because you're here live with us too, that the command would be go find Jody. That seems strange. I have to be honest with you. For no other reason than we are so into how smart our dog is, we have been training our dog to find each other just as a game, by smell in the neighborhood, and he's really good at it. It's literally just like a game. But if I say, where's Brandon? Like if Brandon leaves and he understands we're in that play mode, and I say, where's Brandon? Go find Brandon. And I put him on the leash. He will drag me through the neighborhood, like in a different direction to where Brandon is. And then he'll get rewarded.
That's what I was
going
to say is we do that. Like, it's not really a game for us, but like my dogs, who I've never trained to do this, but when I said dogs are smart, like we have German Shepherds or a German Shepherd now. And I always have to remind Becky that, remember, they don't speak English. They, you know, one word, they're like, Mac will be laying her spot in the bed. And she'll be like, would you please just get up and move away from her? Like, he doesn't know that. If you say, move, he knows what move means. So say move and he'll move. But they also know what names are. If I'm sitting there playing with them and I say, go get your ball, they will run outside, go wander, run through the whole yard until they find their ball and bring their ball back. If I say, go get your mom, they'll run and go to their mom. So if the dog is familiar with Jody's scent and you say, go get Jody, go find Jody, and he's been introduced to Jody enough to know who Jody is, you'd be shocked at how smart dogs are and how they can do that. So that part didn't, with the experience I have with dogs and with training dogs, that part didn't surprise me at all.
Yeah.
If you said, go find Jody, and the dog knows who Jody is, the dogs identify you much more by scent than by sight. That's why when my daughter pulls into our house every day, my dogs bark at her until she walks in the house and they realize that it's her. Because they can smell her. They don't, for some reason, they don't recognize from seeing the car that that's Bella, and she comes here every day.
Right.
But when she walks in the house and they smell her, like, oh, it's Bella. And they get all excited and start wagging their tails.
But in fairness to people who question that, I understand. I mean,
it wholeheartedly.
We're not laughing at anybody who thinks, wait a minute, they passed by that spot and nothing happened. And then they were coming back and then something happened. Like, if it was that. Like, if it was a familiarity with scent, like, would there be nothing at all? Like, would the dog just not, you know, respond? And I understand that. I understand that. Zach, you were saying you questioned that.
I have a very hard time with the dog. I have an extremely hard time with the dog. I'm not saying the dog didn't help Luke find it. And I'm not saying Luke is guilty because of this. I don't mean anything, but I have a very hard time with, I think it's being conflated to make it seem like the dog helped so much more than it really did.
Hmm.
Why do you say that?
There is nothing in my being that shows me that Luke was capable of training a dog, or that this dog was. We do not know that they were around, that Jody was around that long. We've already heard about other girlfriends. I don't know if we've heard about in this. I've researched so much that I don't know what's been told right now. But we've heard about other girlfriends. I don't think that Jody's brown enough that this dog knows Jody's scent. I also have a very hard time knowing what we know about Luke. Knowing about his cleanliness, knowing about the way he takes care of things, that he is training a dog to search for anything. I'm not saying it's not a smart dog. I'm not saying it's not capable of finding something. I think it's being conflated that he came out and was like, go find Jody, and the dog helped him find Jody.
I believe, didn't the family confirm that he said go find Jody to the dog?
The family's changed their story 14 times.
Right, but there's at least in some version of their story, they confirmed
it. They've never said, as far as I know, the family has never said that he said, go find Jody. The family has said that the dog found Jody with Luke.
See, I had heard that the family had said that he put the dog in tracking mode.
Yeah, but what does that mean?
I would just say this, and I appreciate your perspective on it. But I would say this, just as much as you don't know if the dog knew Jody, you also don't know if the dog knew Jody.
You're right. 100%. You know what I mean? You're right.
And that we don't know that Luke's capable of training a dog. We don't know that Luke's not capable of training a dog. And we do know that at least some dogs are very capable of doing exactly what that dog did just based on a name. My dogs can do it. Janet's dogs can do it. So it's possible. It's in the realm of possibilities.
Right.
They do it with the individuals they are in a household with all the time. Not a stranger that comes over once in a while.
But we don't know how much she comes over. We know she was there on Saturday, 2 days before this, right?
Not that I know of.
And yet she was grounded.
Yeah, that was the day that the mom sent the taxi to bring her back. So I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying that you're basing what seems to be a very strong opinion on what we don't know.
Okay.
But if she was grounded... What a question mark. Okay.
Well, the whole grounding thing's a whole...
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
So confusing.
If she was grounded, why did her... Because that part, from what I read, was confirmed. Like, mom knows she was there Saturday. Mom sent the taxi to get... Or the 28th, whatever day that was, to go pick her up from Luke's to bring her home. But then she said... Well, and in the initial interview, she didn't say anything about her being grounded. And then later on, she did 12 interviews before she ever said she was grounded.
That's... Okay. Wow. All right. I'm going to skip just a couple of these. I'm so sorry, Teresa, but you know, you're here that we're running a little long. So, and I think we'll be circling back to some of this stuff, but this is another great question. Was this wall something people often jumped to go in different directions or for privacy, to smoke, drink, hook up near the path, but not on the path where there would be more activity?
From what I read, it was an area that was commonly known for teenagers to go drink and smoke and have sex, do whatever, back there. Is that, you come across that stuff?
Yep. It was known to be a spot for that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. So to that end, Teresa wants to know, is it known that Luke and Jody had maybe ever hopped the wall before?
That I don't know.
Yeah. And I don't think we can, I mean, that's hard to even speculate. We don't know at all.
And then Teresa finally says, when police arrived, wouldn't they have made note of those present and conducted initial interviews? That should have made it clear Luke didn't find her alone.
That is one of the biggest, and that we're going to get into all that this week. That's why I stopped the episode where I did last week, because I'm trying to trace together all the, there was this whole thing where he called 911, said, I found something, get here. And then they call him back. And then he's telling them where they're at. And then they go to the wrong place, and then they go to the right place, and then they don't know who all was there. And then the family had gone to meet the police at the other place and then bring them back to Luke. And then they assumed Luke. So it seemed, now in their defense, from what I understand, this is an extremely low crime. Like, this isn't something that, you know, this isn't Baltimore where they're dealing with murders every day.
Sure.
Like, this, like, they've never dealt with anything like this before. I'll give them a little bit of credit there, but it seems like this was just absolutely botched from the very beginning of this investigation.
Yeah. Well, that is all I have. I say all, but we just had a very long follow-up because we had so much to discuss. And
yeah. So you guys, and you listen to this on Friday and it's an hour and 15 minutes long, remember that when Sunday's episode is 12 minutes
long. Oh, no.
There's a little bit of me that is, because remember, guys, I'm doing all of the editing and everything by myself. And there's a little bit of me that my blood pressure is spiking looking at the time on the Roadcaster right now, that when am I going to get this done? That being said, if you're in the live YouTube right now and you are anxiously awaiting the next episode of the reply brief on Adnan's case for tomorrow, which will be Wednesday, my plan is 100% to get it out Wednesday. It will 100% not be out at 6 a.m. Wednesday, because I have it almost finished the writing of it. I still have to record it and I still have to edit it. I intend to get it out tomorrow. It just may not be at 6 in the morning. If you're listening to this on Friday, it's already out, and just pretend it was out at 6 a.m. on.
You could probably just cut that whole thing out.
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. Gave yourself some more editing.
Yeah.
This feels like a really good opportunity for me to do something that I will not let you cut out, which is, if those of you who just are listening to this and heard the announcement that Bob will in fact be releasing his coverage, his reply briefs on that particular podcast's coverage, and you're like, oh, but I joined Patreon for exactly that reason, I would just remind you, number one, you're still getting early access to them. And number two, stay with us. This poor schlub is having to edit his own podcast. We don't want that. Let me tell you, none of us want that. We want him focusing on the work. And not to say editing isn't an art, it is, but just someone else needs to be doing that fine art so that he can stay focused. He's doing too many things right now. We need your support. I'm sorry, but, you know, again, just, we love you on Patreon for supporting, because that is making this possible, and ideally will create a situation in which Bob is not doing his own editing.
Well, I very much appreciate that, and I do appreciate all the patrons. If you do want to hear and again, at the same time, with all that being said, I'm 100% fine if you just want to wait until October and hear that series for free. I don't want to.
That's why I'm putting the pressure on, and it gave me the opportunity, as Teresa just pointed out, to call you a schlub.
That's true. I appreciate calling me a schlub. I gotta stop talking. We're an hour and 23 Goodbye. Minutes in.
We love you guys.
We love you guys. We'll see you next week.
Bye, guys.
This is an NBI Studios production. All music for the show is created and composed by Shane Yoder at PutThemInASong.com. The font you see on all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Katie Ross of createdintandem.com design, created, manages, and maintains our website, Truth and Justice Pod, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Erica Cantor, Melissa Cardenas, Kay Woodyomnik, and Danielle Rohr. And as always, thank you to all of you for your engagement and your support. If you like the show and you want to support us, you can do that in a number of ways. The number one way for you to support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. If you join our Patreon, not only will you be financially supporting our work, but you'll also get something for your pledge. For just $5 per month, you'll get all episodes ad-free and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups that include an hour-long pre-show chat exclusive to our patrons. Other levels will get you a Truth and Justice Army t-shirt, Truth and Justice hats, and even the opportunity to co-host a Friday follow-up episode. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny, and it goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a case that you'd like us to consider covering, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is engage in our investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page, follow us on Instagram, or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. And for all of you tweeters out there, you can connect with us on Twitter @TruthJusticePod. To follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found @BobRuffTruth. Janet can be found @JanetVarney, and Zach is @Z2TheQ. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.